From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's easier than you might think to get access to private information about individuals by tapping into credit bureau data banks. That's how investigative journalist Jeffrey Rothfader obtained private information on Dan Quayle and Dan Rather. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rothfader about his new book, Privacy for Sale. And speaking of private life, what's more private than your sexual life? It's the subject writers often leave out of their memoirs, but it's the only focus of Richard Rhodes' new memoir. There's a good reason why, he'll tell us. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's season opener of Murphy Brown and previews Mad About You, a new sitcom that premieres tomorrow night. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Governor Bill Clinton showed up today in East Lansing, Michigan, as he'd promised, attacking President Bush for refusing to debate there. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Governor Bill Clinton addressed a rally on the campus of Michigan State University, attacking the president for his economic record and for his refusal to accept the terms of the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. Clinton accepted the commission's format for a single moderator, a format Clinton claims would allow for a more substantive debate.
And he didn't want to do that because he'd have a harder time with his politics of diversion, division, and denial. I guess I can't blame him. If I had the worst record of any president in 50 years, I wouldn't want to defend that record either.
Today, the Bipartisan Commission sent a letter to both campaigns suggesting that the two sides meet to discuss resolving their differences over the format. A Clinton campaign spokesman said they'd be willing to discuss changes as long as the commission conducted the negotiations. The Bush campaign turned down the commission's offer. It wants discussions face-to-face. I'm Mara Liasson reporting.
President Bush spent the day in a campaign sweep of six states that encircle Governor Bill Clinton's home state of Arkansas. The president said that Clinton's record as governor belies his rhetoric as a candidate, saying that he's promised the moon but delivered little to Arkansas. The president accused Clinton of more than doubling Arkansas's state spending since 1983 and paying for it with regressive taxes that hurt poor and working families the most. British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd says that the international community must rely more on diplomacy and less on peacekeeping if it wants to prevent wars. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports from the United Nations.
Speaking for the European community, Hurd responded to UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali's recent report recommending ways to strengthen the UN's peacekeeping capacity. Hurd endorsed parts of the report, but he did not mention Boutros-Ghali's proposal to create a permanent UN army to deter aggression. Instead, he said, we must not load down the UN with too heavy or expensive a burden out of a misguided sense that something must be done to end wars.
We have to realize where that impulse, where that phrase, something must be done, leads us. And we should not wander down this road without serious thought.
Hurd suggested that the best way to prevent conflicts from breaking out is diplomacy. He said diplomacy takes time and lacks glamour or news value, but is indispensable. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 40 points to close at 3,280.85. Declines led advances by more than 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Diplomats at the Yugoslav peace talks in Geneva said today that international mediators are urging the warring parties to consider making Sarajevo a demilitarized zone. A spokesman for the mediator said that the idea had come up in discussion and that it's likely to come up again. The conference is being sponsored by the United Nations and the European Community, with Cyrus Vance and the EC's Lord Owen as its primary mediators. The spokesman didn't say how the demilitarization idea was received by Muslim, Croatian, and Serbian negotiators. One of the nation's most restrictive abortion laws is one step closer to a Supreme Court review. Jim Engster reports from Baton Rouge.
A federal appeals court has upheld a judge's order blocking Louisiana's abortion law. It provides for prison sentences of up to 10 years for doctors who perform abortions. Attorney General Richard Ayoub is plotting the state's next move.
We now have 90 days in which to file for writs of certiorari to the Supreme Court of the United States, asking them to review the decision of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal.
The statute permits abortions only to save the life of the mother and in some circumstances in cases of rape and incest. It directly challenges the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion in America. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Engster in Baton Rouge.
It looks as if President Bush will get nearly all the money he requested for the controversial space station project. House Senate negotiators agreed today to provide $2.1 billion for the project next year. Opponents of the space station have tried to cut off its funding, claiming it's too expensive and has very little scientific value. The space station is expected to cost $40 billion to build and $100 billion more to operate over its planned 30-year lifespan. The money for the space station was included in an $87 billion compromise funding measure. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeffrey Rothfader, used his home computer to get personal data on Dan Quayle, Dan Rather, and Arsenio Hall. Rothfader got the information by tapping into computerized credit data banks. My guest is not a computer criminal. He's an investigative reporter and a former editor at Businessweek. His new book, Privacy for Sale, warns how easy it is to get access to private information about you and me stored in the huge data banks of credit bureaus. The credit bureaus have information supplied by banks, insurance companies, department stores, collection agencies, credit unions, doctors, courthouses, and motor vehicle agencies. The safeguards of privacy have not caught up with the computer age. I asked Rothfader why, as part of his research, he tapped into the credit bureau files on Dan Quayle.
I believe strongly, as an investigative reporter in sort of advocacy journalism, to the extent where you go in and show people how it can be done in order to prove to them that it can be done. And I decided to take a test case, and I chose Dan Quayle mainly because I didn't want to be frivolous. I didn't want to pick a celebrity like Liz Taylor or something like that. I felt that wasn't serious enough. So I picked Dan Quayle and decided to see if I could access his credit report. I mean, after all, he's also the vice president, and I figured if I could access his credit report, then nobody's was safe from being protected.
So where did you start?
Well, I had heard, as I started looking at the business, I learned about what I call the information underground, which are not the big information resellers like TRW, Equifax, TransUnion, you know, and all the direct marketers, but it's sort of this underground level that subscribes to the bigger ones and then resells it. And they're a lot less careful about who they sell it to. And I had been told that there's this niche that exists, and I began to, you know, talking from one source to the next, started to get some names of some of these companies. And I started calling them up. I found out that I call these companies super bureaus because they essentially collect information from a lot of others and put them together. So they're, in a sense, bigger than the big ones they hook into, at least in breadth of what they provide. And so I called up one of the super bureaus and said now, to get a credit report, let me back up one second. To get a credit report in the United States, you have to have what is called a permissible business purpose. It's really poorly defined. It could be anything. It could be I'm selling you a lawnmower and I'm going to pay you out for 2 months, and or you're going to pay me out for 2 months, and so I want to check on your credit report. It also could be I felt a journalistic exercise. That's permissible business purpose. So I called up the Super Bureau. I told them I was from McGraw-Hill, which owns Business Week, and that I was thinking of hiring some people. And I just simply said that. I said that I wanted to run some background checks on it. They sent me the application. I filled it out, making mistakes on the application on purpose, meaning they asked for a federal ID number. I didn't know McGraw-Hill's federal ID number, so I made one up. At another part of the application, they asked for it again. I made up a different one. They asked for bank account information from McGraw-Hill. Of course, I didn't have that. I said, that's not available. So I basically made it easy to be caught because I wanted to see if this, where the levels of protection stood. I really bungled my way into this. And they made it impossible to be caught because they accepted my application. They said they wanted to check me a little bit further, and they came to the McGraw-Hill building, which is a skyscraper in New York, looked at the building, which says McGraw-Hill on it, and said, well, that's legit. They basically were just checking on the legitimacy of the McGraw-Hill company. After that, they gave me a password, And I was able to go online into the system and access anybody's credit report, which of course includes the Social Security number and their jobs, their backgrounds, their salaries, their judgments, and so on.
So you mean once you get the go-ahead from one of these super bureaus, you can get anybody's information?
Oh, yeah. There's no questions asked at that point. Once you're online, you're online. And with Dan Quayle, I didn't have, and interestingly, you don't need a Social Security number or anything to get the report. You just need an address, a name and an address. With Quayle, I didn't have his address. So I looked up an old who's who. It was about a 10-year-old who's who, found an old address for him in Indiana, typed in Dan Quayle, typed in his address in Indiana, and then immediately the computer responded, a.k.a. J. Danforth Quayle, his current address, and just printed out the credit report. I was afraid that the next day or so I'd get caught, you know, that somebody would call me and say, what are you doing? Nobody did. I was able to do it. I could have kept on looking up anybody's credit report, except that I published it in Business Week, and they shut me down. They shut my password down at that point. Since then, I've opened up new passwords at other companies. I subsequently, for the book, for Privacy for Sale, I've gotten a lot more information on individuals by going into a lot deeper databases. If you'd like, I'd go into the Dan Rather experiment.
Sure. Now, you chose Dan Rather as a subject because he has a reputation for being very private and having gone to extremes to protect his private information.
Yeah. You know, Dan Rather is obviously a target of some weird people from time to time, and he's also a target of the right wing, which considers him far too liberal. And so he has taken care to protect it. And also, he's not the kind of celebrity that hangs out at bars and parties that much. So some of the ways he's protected it, for instance, is he's actually told the information industry or people, companies he deals with, that his information must be protected or he'll sue. And that in a way is enough because here's a man with obviously a salary of $3-5 million whatever a year, and so he's got the resources to do something like that, and a big enough name. However, I didn't find it that much more difficult to get information about Rather. I tapped into and when I use tap, I don't mean by hacking. I simply got access to a super bureau that sells much more than credit reports. That sells not only credit reports, but Social Security information, bank account balance information, telephone records, credit card bills themselves, so you can see where people have shopped, and those kinds of things. And you know, virtually through this kind of super bureau, there's almost nothing you can buy, coming up with the right amount of money and the right request.
So how much money did you spend buying information on Rather?
Well, Rather, because I limited it to just a few pieces of information, I only ended up spending about $300 on it. I accessed a credit report of his first because I didn't have any information about him, as obviously like his Social Security number and all that. So I used the credit report effectively to get the Social Security number and his current address, as well as any credit information that I wanted to see. And then I accessed a credit card bill based on the credit card he uses the most, which I took out of his credit report. I looked at which one he had high activity on, got a bill for a one-month period, at which time I could see, you know, where he shopped, what kind of money he spent, and you know, where he ate, and so on.
So your point here, I think, is that if you could get information on Dan Quayle and Dan Rather, mm-hmm. then anyone could get information on you and me.
Yeah, which occurs all the time, unfortunately, and more. And as I said, with non-celebrities, when I've been experimenting, I've had no trouble getting any kinds of information with no questions asked. I mean, even the phone bills and so on. It was a lot easier.
These super bureaus that you've been tapping into to buy information mm-hmm. on people, are they legal?
Yeah, one of the problems is there are virtually no privacy laws in the United States. Almost all kinds of information, from medical records to bank account records, telephone records, credit card bills, are not protected by any privacy laws. Credit reports are protected by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. However, as I said to you before, what that law says is that anyone with a, and that's the quote, permissible business purpose can access a credit report. And so it's virtually being, that loophole is being used by anybody who wants to get in. I mean, again, my permissible business purposes was I was doing a journalistic exercise. That stretched it as far as some people in the credit industry felt, but there was nothing they could do to stop me. And so the super bureaus are basically acting openly and legally in their actions.
Now, how do they get the information? Who do they get it from?
Well, they subscribe, depending on the information you're talking about, but if you take, obviously, the credit reports, they subscribe to the big three credit bureaus, and they simply resell that data. Other kinds of information, like phone records, bank account balances, medical records and things like that, are accessible by, basically, it has to be people who are working at those organizations, meaning if I'm going to get Dan Rather's telephone records, then somebody at New York Telephone is leaking that information out. And that is, as I said, about anybody, not difficult to do. But part of the problem is it's being leaked out probably by a clerk who's sitting at a desk who's making $15,000 a year who doesn't mind collecting another $500 or maybe $200 or whatever to leak out a phone bill. The problem is that person will never get caught, and that's why it's so easy to do, because virtually no companies have audit trails. Virtually no companies can figure out who accessed what yesterday. That just isn't part of most computer systems. So it makes it easy to leak it out, and it makes it easy for some of these people to make some extra money doing that. Then once it gets onto the super bureau trail, into their network, that's how it gets delivered to people like me.
My guest is journalist Jeffrey Rothfader. He's the author of the new book, Privacy for Sale. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Rothfader, author of the new book, Privacy for Sale, How Computerization Has Made Everyone's Private Life an Open Secret. Okay, so you've explained something about how these super bureaus work. There's also kind of like computer billboards that have a lot of information on people. Would you explain how those are, what those are and how they work?
Yeah, there are quite a few, obviously, quite a few online networks these days, like CompuServe and Nexus, and there are probably a half a dozen others, virtually exist to sell information. Now, generally, they are online networks that sell, research information, like back issues of articles in magazines and so on. But increasingly, they are providing more personal information of what is considered to be a public nature. Meaning, for instance, on CompuServe, there is something called a phone file, in which by just typing in someone's name and state or general location, you can access everyone else with that name and their addresses and their phone numbers and the family demographics, even meaning how many people are in the family. In the book, I happened to just be playing around with it one day. Some people have looked up Madonna in it and found it, for instance, in other experiments. I have been playing around with it. I typed in Dylan, thinking I might find Bob Dylan. I didn't find him, but I found Sarah Dylan, his wife, who has been virtually reclusive from the press and the media and everyone else ever since their divorce many years ago. So, and there I had her address and her phone number. And, in fact, I spoke to Bob Dylan's biographer and checked it out with him, and he said, it's amazing. I couldn't even talk to her. And you got that easily on CompuServe. Nexus, on the other hand, sells real estate records, which, again, are public information, mortgage information and all that. You can go down to the local town hall of the county, let's say, where someone lives or the town where someone lives and find out what their house is like, what their mortgage is like, the value of the property and so on. That's old-fashioned, though, because you'd have to go to that town, travel there, and so on. Nexus is selling it online for much of the country, meaning that they've got most of this real estate information now computerized. And, you see, I think that's a key point here, too, is that, the way things used to be, even within public information like driver's license records, which are public information, as I said, real estate records and tax information and so on, it used to be much more difficult to get because you'd have to go somewhere physically, sign a piece of paper saying, this is what I want. You have to get through a clerk and they'll be on record that you access this information. Now that it's computerized, you can essentially be a voyeur very silently, very quietly, sitting at your computer at home, and no one will ever ask you why you did it. And the person that you looked up won't even know that you ever did.
What are the controls supposed to be on these computer networks?
Well, none really. That's part of the problem. I mean, there are no real controls. As I said, no laws. And also, within most companies, they have not paid the price to build in controls that would enable someone to check who looked up what yesterday and why, or even ask someone, be able to ask someone at the point of entry. I mean, for instance, when you're getting a credit report, maybe the smallest of diligence would say that when I type in Dan Quayle and it comes back, a.k.a. J. Danforth Quayle, maybe it should have asked me the question, do you have a permissible business purpose to get this credit report, yes or no? If I had typed yes, in a sense, I'm going a little bit further with this ruse, and maybe I'm sort of committing some kind of perjury or something like that. I don't know how I'd feel about it, but at least that much. At least they'd have that on record. Nobody asked that question at all, and in none of these networks do they ever ask why you want this or to prove for any reason that you have a right to have it.
Well, I think most people would agree they don't want other people to get their phone number. But what about their medical records? Did you find medical records are being made available in this way?
Yeah, although the reason for accessing it is different, so it's somewhat of a different scenario. There is a place called the Medical Information Bureau that's up in Cambridge, in Boston, that collects medical records about most of us. Collects doctor records, hospital records, and records from insurers. This is a consortium of the nation's insurance companies. And basically, the reason for the Medical Information Bureau is to stop fraud. I mean, this way, when you fill out an insurance application and you say that you don't smoke, MIB probably knows if you smoke because you've probably either told your doctor, a hospital might know about it, or you told an insurer about it before. And once you've told them, it'll get onto this MIB file. That kind of data is very important to insurers. And insurers will say it keeps their costs down and keeps the cost down to the consumer and so on. Unfortunately, because data like that is now centralized in a data bank, it now becomes much more available to people who want to get at it. Now, you know, in most cases, it's not going to be the hacker type that's going to break into MIB, but it's going to be people that now have access to that kind of information and will use it in one way or another. For instance, employers can get MIB information. Usually you've signed that when you get a job, you sign that they can continue to do background checks on you. Most people sign that boilerplate statement, meaning 5 years after you have that job, an employer might check with MIB because you're acting a little strange and wondering, well, you know, I wonder, has he been going to AA lately or anything like that? Well, they can check that and find that out. Insurers obviously can get that information, even if you're not going for insurance with them. And there have been cases where some insurers, people who work in insurance companies, have actually gossiped about one guy, one particular man I know, it's a very horrible story, up in upstate New York, small town, local businessman, he has AIDS. It got onto the MIB network. This insurer happened to be checking around about some of his clients and all and other people's clients to do business with them, saw this listing that this man had AIDS at a local Rotary Club luncheon one day. He went and gossiped it to other people there. By the next day, the entire town knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, if it wasn't for MIB, that kind of information wouldn't be available.
What would you recommend that individuals do to safeguard information about themselves?
Well, it's very, very difficult, frankly. What people have to do, for instance, is get your credit report once or twice a year. This way you can look to see if anybody, first of all, on the credit report, it'll say who has accessed it. It won't say individuals. Like in the case when I accessed Dan Quayle's credit report, it listed, so on Dan Quayle's credit report would go a listing of the Super Bureau, meaning because that's basically the accessor of
right.
it. You know what I mean? So, but still, Dan Quayle, if he had looked at his credit report and let's say I hadn't published this information, he could have then said, well, who's this? And why did they look at my credit report? So it does list the names of places. So that can at least put you on your toes a little bit. Also, obviously, if there's any hint, become more vigilant about knowing how this business works. Because if there is any hint of any kind of scam going on in your life, if it sounds like someone knows your phone numbers or things like that, then you've got to take the step by, let's say, calling the phone company and saying, you leaked out some information about me, I know you have, and I'm going to take action. Now, I'm not sure there really is any action to take. But, you know, you should say, I'm going to take action unless you start closing the loops on these things. And maybe that will slow it down a little bit. The other thing, I was going to say is, you know, deal with Congress. I mean, there are constantly laws introduced, and maybe if Congress felt that consumers were getting that upset, they might do something about it.
How do you get your credit report?
Well, all three of, the two main credit bureaus, TRW and Equifax, will they have an 800 numbers that you can get through the 800 number listing that you just simply call up, and you can request a copy of your credit report, by giving certain background information like where you've lived, your date of birth, mother's maiden name, that kind of stuff. And TRW will give you one free credit report each year. Equifax charges you about $8 for your credit report.
Are you afraid that your book is going to be used as a how-to book for people who want to access people's private information that they really should not be accessing?
Yeah, I am, and that always disturbs me in general about this. You know, every time I've done anything about the subject, the calls and the letters that I get, even at home, I mean, people try to track me down, and they're so proud when they found my home number. It's listed in the phone book, actually, to tell you the truth. I always hear from people who want to find somebody or want to access information on somebody, or, you know, somebody's run off with their kids. I mean, a marital dispute and things like that. And a lot of times they're legitimate, tragic stories. And people want to use this system to do that. And, you know, they always ask me how, and I never tell them because I don't know what kind of harm's going to follow from it. I mean, I am afraid that people will use it to, let's say, find somebody and then commit some kind of harm against them or something like that if they get mad enough. That's a problem. Unfortunately, we are all very gossipy about each other. I think what the thing is that we prize our own privacy but not that of others. I think that's a very big problem in this country. And so, you know, most people will ask me, for instance, what did you find on Dan Quayle's credit report? What did you find about Dan Rather? I mean, people want to know that kind of stuff. And so on purpose, I didn't put a how-to in the book. I mean, I showed how I did it, but I didn't give names and addresses and phone numbers of the kinds of companies to access to do it. If people go ahead and do it on their own, there's nothing I can do about that, but I am concerned about that.
Well, Jeffrey Rothfader, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Rothfader is a reporter, former information management editor at Businessweek. His new book is called Privacy for Sale: How Computerization Has Made Everyone's Private Life an Open Secret. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, one man's sexual odyssey. Richard Rhodes' new memoir, Making Love, is an account of how he used his sexuality to work through the damage of child abuse. One reviewer calls it a stunning act of self-revelation bound to create a stir. Last night, Dan Quayle became a character in the sitcom he attacked. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season opener of Murphy Brown. And he previews the new sitcom, Mad About You, starring Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has denied charges that the Nixon administration knowingly abandoned American prisoners of war in its haste to disengage from Vietnam back in 1973. His rebuttal came today during a day of an emotional and sometimes angry testimony before the Senate Select Committee on POW/MIA Affairs. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
Yesterday, two of Richard Nixon's defense secretaries claimed the administration negotiated and completed a pullout from Vietnam, even though there was evidence of American airmen being left in Laos. That set the stage for today's dramatic testimony from Henry Kissinger.
Leaks assert that when President Nixon announced that all prisoners were on their way home, he or his aides knew that many were left behind. That allegation is a flat-out lie.
Kissinger said in 1973 he knew of no confirmed reports of Americans left behind and said if there were, the blame belongs to the North Vietnamese as well as to Congress, which he said limited the administration's ability to press Hanoi to live up to its treaty obligations. This is Anthony Brooks in Washington.
Once again, the Bush camp has turned down a debate proposal by a bipartisan presidential commission. Bush campaign chairman Robert Teeter has written the panel that he will only discuss debate arrangements directly with the Clinton camp. Aides to Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton had accepted an invitation to debate next week in Louisville. The first debate had been slated for tonight in Michigan, but the Bush camp objected to the use of a single moderator, as recommended by the bipartisan commission. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has overwhelmingly approved a bill to re-regulate the cable television industry. The measure now goes to President Bush, who has promised a veto. NPR's Brian Nader reports.
The Senate vote was 74 to 25, more than the two-thirds majority necessary to override a veto. The House, too, indicated it has the votes to override, and this puts the president and congressional Republicans in a quandary. The president says the measure calling on the FCC to set a ceiling for basic cable rates is unnecessary and burdensome. Nonetheless, it is popular with consumers who feel they've been gouged by cable companies who have raised prices on average at three times the inflation rate. If Mr. Bush makes good on his veto promise, congressional Republicans have to decide whether to desert and embarrass their president, who has yet to have a veto overturned by Congress, or risk the wrath of their constituents by voting against what's been painted as a popular pro-consumer bill. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 40 points to close at 3,280.85 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Officials in Denmark say another vote will be held on a European unification treaty. It was turned down there earlier this year by a slim margin. At the same time, Dutch officials say they are opposed to a single EC currency by 1999. Last week, troubled financial markets dealt a blow to efforts to tie EC currencies together. A second vote in Denmark to be held by mid-1993 delays implementation, which had been slated for January. Lebanese officials believe that Ron Ayrod, an Israeli airman shot down in Lebanon 6 years ago, is alive. That word today from the Arab-Israeli peace talks, currently underway in Washington, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israel's concern about Ayrod matches U.S. concern about Americans missing in the Vietnam War. Some authorities feared that Ayrod had been executed in retaliation for Israeli attacks in southern Lebanon. Others suspected he was being held by militants. Many Israelis hoped Arad would be released as part of the negotiations that freed American hostages in Lebanon, but that didn't happen. So Israeli negotiators at the Mideast peace talks asked their Lebanese counterparts to inquire about Arad. Today, Uri Lubrani, the co-chair of Israel's delegation, said, "We received a reply that the Lebanese government has reason to believe that Navigator Arad is alive." Lubrani said Lebanese authorities don't know who is holding Arad, but said they promised to pursue the matter to the best of their ability. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The government says that the nation's deficit grew by nearly $25 billion last month, just about assuring there will be a new deficit record set this year. For the first 11 months of the fiscal year, the nation's deficit grew to more than $295.5 billion. That's $30 billion more than it was last year at the same time. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sex is the most private of private subjects. Most of us would have no interest in revealing the details of our sexual lives to others, and we might not want to know about the intimate details of anyone else's. That's why some people think Richard Rhodes was crazy to write his new memoir, while others think writing the book was an act of courage. His new book, Making Love, is a memoir of his sexual life. It's a companion book to his previous critically acclaimed memoir, A Hole in the World, about how he was abused by his stepmother. Rhodes has quite a resume. He won a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. His book, Farm, was a profile of a family farm. In his new memoir, he reveals that he also ghostwrote two sex manuals. I asked Richard Rhodes to read from the preface of his new memoir, Making Love.
There are war stories and tales of survival. There are political memoirs and confessions of faith. But in all of Western literature, there are only a very few personal narratives that honestly and frankly explore the intimate experience of making love, and hardly any to which an author has been willing to sign his name. Although sex is one of the perplexing, joyous, difficult, and transcendent experiences of life, although studies indicate that people think about sex dozens of times every living day, hardly anyone has come forward to write about it intimately except behind the mask of fiction. Fiction is fine, but using fiction as a disguise makes both the uniqueness of intimate experience and its common humanity easy to dispute. Making love is fact, verity, as I call nonfiction. It happened. Everything in this book is true. Why talk about it?
That's my first question. Why talk about it?
Well, you know, it's as if I walked into a place where there was a wall and climbed to the top of the wall and discovered that on the other side was this lush garden with all sorts of curious topiaries and beasts running around in the undergrowth, and none of the guys with their notebooks were there. This is a huge part and a common part of human experience, and except for fiction, where I think we always have the question, did this really happen or is this guy making it up? Very little is ever said. As a writer, I saw it as an area of opportunity. As a human being, I'm curious to know about other people and their behaviors and wanted to write about, therefore, my own.
You know, although we think about sex, I think it makes us uncomfortable to hear the intimate details of someone's life. Even like really kind of prurient people, I think, get vaguely embarrassed.
Oh, yes. No, in fact, the experience that I've had since the book has left my desk has been friends, often very sophisticated friends, who, having read the book, have nothing whatsoever to say about it. It's as if this particular discourse is not available in a public forum.
Well, I think you're a very brave man for writing this book, because I think, you know, writing a sexual memoir really leaves you open to ridicule, because people love to ridicule people about their most intimate feelings and thoughts.
Oh, yes.
Fantasies.
And already in at least one of the reviews that the book has received, I've had a good round of ridicule. I understood that when I sat down to write this book. But given the premise, which is I would simply tell the story of my sexual experiences through my life, some of them, not all of them, the best of them, and maybe some of the worst of them, too, I assumed that, ridicule would be one of the responses, as it has been for many people who have been revealed in one way or another publicly over the years.
Another response would be, well, this guy must have a touch of the exhibitionist in him.
Well, I hope we all do. And I would certainly assume that anyone who writes must have, especially someone who writes, as I do, not only about facts, but also about personal experiences. In my previous books, working on a farm or writing about my childhood, I mean, I've been down that road already.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Rhodes, and he won a Pulitzer for his book on the making of the atom bomb, and he has a memoir called A Hole in the World. His new book is a memoir about sexuality and love. It's called Making Love. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Rhodes, author of the new book, Making Love, An Erotic Odyssey. It's a memoir. Since this is a subject I assume you've thought about a lot, I want to ask you if you think there's a difference between what is stimulating in fantasy and what is stimulating in real life, and whether you've found there to be a direct correlation most of the time or not in your own life.
There is a long chapter in Making Love about autoeroticism, about self-stimulation. I think I make it clear there that particular experience of mine, which has been extensive and practiced for a very long time, has its differences from my sexual experience with women, with partners. The difference has to do, I think I finally came to understand, with my use of self-stimulation as a kind of a laboratory for learning to deal with all the rage that came out of my child abuse. Sex is one place where people put their emotions and learn to deal with their emotions, whether it's sex with themselves or sex with others. And so for me, at least, those two kinds of behaviors are significantly different. They're both pleasurable, I think, but the one has a much larger component of violence, if you will, than the other. Perhaps one of the reasons autoeroticism has been important to me as someone who came out of being abused, not sexually by my stepmother, but very close to sexually. My stepmother tried to control and did manage to control when I would go to the bathroom at night, and that was a particularly exquisite and genital torture.
Well, she'd prevent you from going at night. You weren't allowed to use the toilet at night.
And it's and that experience clearly for me as one human being with a particular personal history may be very different from what other people have. But for me, there's a disjunction between my intimacy with a woman and my intimacy with myself.
Well, I could think that one connection. You know, the genitals serve dual functions, you know, of course, with both pleasure and elimination. And, your mother inflicted pain on you in the elimination area because she wouldn't allow you to use the bathroom at night. And, do you think that somehow, like, pain and pleasure ever connected in your mind because of that?
Well, one of the things that I explore in Making Love is the degree to which self-stimulation became a way, a drama, a ritual and a drama, rather obsessive, to triumph over that cathartic childhood and repetitious childhood experience of what has to be called simply torture. Because the climax of self-stimulation is release, and that's exactly what my stepmother, in the context of urination, refused to allow me. So each time over my lifetime, I have used self-stimulation, if you will. I've refought a battle and won it.
You know, I guess what I always want to know in situations like this is if you feel that your sexual thoughts, sexual fantasies are somehow caught up with or reflective of
something terrible that happened in your life earlier, like abuse, do you try to disassociate yourself with that and say, well, I'm going to try to not feel this because I think this feeling comes out of something bad that happened in my life? Or do you just accept that there's some connection there and work with it? Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the points of writing about this part of my sexuality is to discuss an area of healing from violence that most of the literature about child abuse and healing doesn't discuss, which is to say the use of one's sexuality as a healing process. I think that this particular pattern for me does involve going through those complex feelings of violence and rage as well as pleasure to the other side, with the other side being something that's physical and orgasmic and very deeply pleasurable.
You know, as we talk, I feel like reassuring listeners by saying, I know this might sound a little intense to you, but hey, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Do you know? He got a National Book Award. Do you feel that you could have only written this book in a way with the credentials that you have?
Yes. In fact, I think of the example of Bill Masters, William Masters. He wanted to study human sexuality from medical school. One of his advisors suggested to him that he should first make his name in some other area of medicine. And in fact, Bill Masters pioneered estrogen replacement therapy as a gynecologist researcher. Then and only then, when he felt he had credentials that required others to take him seriously, did he explore this very touchy and difficult area of human experience. I felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are other reasons why the book came through. It was after I'd written A Hole in the World, after I'd talked about what to me were much more difficult things to discuss, such as this, what we've just been discussing, torture, being tortured. It was considerably less difficult to talk about something that I share with most other people, which is my sexuality.
The last third of your book is, as you say, a love story, a sexual love story. You meet the woman who you're still partners with, and you describe your relationship, but you also describe, you know, many, many afternoons and nights of lovemaking. One of the things that you and she tried, especially early on in the relationship, was extending sexual response, and she often had multiple orgasms. And I guess it's, you know, toward the end of the book, she says to you that she doesn't want that anymore. And you get very angry with her.
Yes, yes.
Why was that your response, getting angry with her?
Well, I had been pursuing what was essentially a vision that had been a part of my fantasy life for many years, of a woman who might be perpetually orgasmic, perpetually satisfied. That tied my relationship with G back into the complex feelings I had from my stepmother years. Here was, in a woman, what I had been looking for within myself, a release, an enormous release. And following that fantasy in the relationship had distracted me from my partner as a fellow human being with her own interests and her own degrees of pleasure, her own levels of intensity that she wanted to pursue. And finally, we came to a point where we realized there was something wrong and worked it through to the point where she told me what was wrong, which is that I was pushing too hard. Well, that was very difficult to accept. It took me all summer of talking it through with her to accept the fact of her separate humanity and her separate needs. I think it was a marvelous lesson for me as someone who had been driven to follow a particular fantasy and to find it in a relationship. That, of course, was not all that had developed in the relationship, or it would not have survived the conflict. We had also found in each other two people who were very similar. Her background was also one of abuse as a child. We had a lot of similar interests.
How does it feel for you now to be in a relationship that isn't new and isn't at its initial kind of sexual euphoria. Do you know what I mean? Do you feel that you need to always have that?
No. In fact, what happens, I think, in any relationship is that you, if you pay attention to each other, is that you get very good at pleasuring each other. Then the trick is not to get so good that you reduce the surprise, that you reduce the new possibilities of stimulation to the point where the kind of, I don't want to say boredom, because I've certainly never bored with her, where there's a reduction in the intensity of feeling. That's a trick, and that's a problem, and I think every relationship has that problem. So we're at a very comfortable level now. In fact, what we find most of all, as most people who are active do, is trying to find enough time for lovemaking in the course of every week. So that's pretty normal. And I think one of the things I celebrate in the book in describing this relationship is the achievement of what both G and I think of must be normal, because normal wasn't part of our past. It's nice to feel as if we might be closer to what other people would say is normal, sexually and otherwise.
You know, but you get a lot of sympathy for people when you've had a past that isn't normal, if you've been abused and you've been a victim. If you have a life that isn't considered sexually normal, you get a lot of ostracism and a lot of distrust.
Oh, well, of course, we see it in all sorts of ways in America today. It's horrifying. It's horrifying that an area that we all have in common, that is, as people used to say, the poor man's pleasure, that to me is, the bedroom is the place where democracy begins. It's the first place where two people are together and have to negotiate their relationship. That's a little political system. That's the first little nation state, if you will. And that's why I think it becomes such a politicized area of human behavior. Politicized by religions, politicized, as we've seen recently, in politics. This whole terrible cant about family values and the terrible homophobia that goes with it. These things all point out just how significantly this is a little cauldron of freedom. And I'm not surprised that a lot of people want to manipulate it.
Well, Richard Rhodes, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Richard Rhodes' new memoir is Making Love. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. We'll hear a report on a Capitol Hill clash between former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and members of a Senate committee over charges that the Nixon administration abandoned prisoners of war in 1973 when the U.S. was withdrawing from Vietnam. Lynn Neary talks with Tom Gelton, who has more details on the alleged execution of 200 Slavic Muslim men last month. And Michael Sullivan reports on the rising number of racial attacks in Great Britain. Immigrants there, like in France and Germany, have come under increasingly violent assaults. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This is officially day two of the new fall TV season. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has some thoughts on two noteworthy sitcoms, one that premieres tomorrow night and one that was televised last night.
I won't even bother to play a clip from last night's Murphy Brown. Either you saw it for yourself, or you probably heard or saw highlights on one of today's morning shows, because the Murphy Brown counterattack on Dan Quayle is being treated as big news. My take on the show? I liked the way Candace Bergen as Murphy delivered her response on FYI, the show within a show. That made sense, and the message was an effective one. But I hated the way Murphy Brown ended, with a truckload of potatoes being delivered to the vice president as a practical joke. It wasn't very practical, and it sure wasn't much of a joke. Actually, what I found most interesting was that in real life, Quayle sent a stuffed animal and a letter to Murphy's fictional baby boy. It reminded me of when Barbara Bush made a crack about The Simpsons, then sent a letter of apology to Marge, a cartoon character on that show. Politicians sometimes argue that TV viewers are influenced by characters on the tube and take them too seriously. But we're not the ones using them as pen pals. When politicians refer to TV, whether it's the single motherhood of Murphy Brown or the sarcasm of Where's the Beef, they tap into our most common vocabulary, then seem surprised when they get such a vocal and immediate reaction. And attacks on TV can, and usually do, backfire. Murphy Brown, thanks to Quayle, has received more free hype than any sitcom since Terry Ricolta attacked Married with Children. It's unlikely that tomorrow night's new sitcom, NBC's Mad About You, will ever get the attention or the audience that Murphy Brown just enjoyed. But it's an infinitely better and funnier show, and it's the one people ought to be talking about. Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt star as working New Yorkers who have been married less than a year. The show follows Seinfeld, and it's very much in the same vein. People don't throw out punchlines, they just talk and argue and worry.
It doesn't bother you that we haven't had sex in 5 days?
Hello.
I just don't understand why it doesn't bother you. It's been almost a week.
It's not a week.
Sunday will be a week. What's going on with us?
What's going on is that we're married 5 months and the sexual part is over. See, I thought you understood that. I'm sorry. That's what happens now. I play checkers in the park and you start arguing with buses. Come on.
One thing I really like about this series is that even though it's built around Reiser, who co-created it with executive producer Danny Jacobson, Hunt's character is given equal time and equal attention. And Hunt, who's better known as a dramatic actress, is even given the opportunity to imitate Reiser in this scene with actress Anne Ramsey, who plays her sister.
Trust me, you married the perfect guy. Oh, yeah, unless you're like, you know, sitting in a restaurant starving to death waiting to order. I'm thinking soup, but... they only have bisque, and I'm uneasy with bisque. I don't know why. Believe me, nothing's perfect.
Based on the pilot episodes of all the new fall shows, Mad About You is the best new sitcom of the season and has the most likable characters. Make sure to watch them. But take my advice, please, and don't bother to write to them.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with incumbent Republican Senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter. Challenging him for his Senate seat is Lynn Yackel, a first-time candidate who was inspired to run after Specter's questioning of Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. It's one of this year's closely watched races. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.